It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Baseball, America's pastime. The 20 years at the beginning of the 20th century became known in the baseball world as the dead ball era. Entire games were played with a single ball, and the emphasis was on defense and pitching. Jason Novak, an Oakland-based cartoonist, has put together a book of drawings and, well, let's call them microbiographies, highlighting the lives of the famous and not-so-famous players of the day. And the book is titled Baseball Epic, Famous and Forgotten Lives of the Dead Ball Era. He'll be joining us to talk about, well, what else? Baseball. So, are you a baseball history buff? What do you love about it? Who's your favorite player, or rather your favorite, maybe your favorite game from the past? Have you learned about the dead ball era? What stands out to you? Parents, do you teach your kids about America's pastime? And if so, why do you think it's important? And have you experienced games with your family? What about teachers? Do you find your students enjoy sports history? How do you use sports to teach larger lessons? Get a hold of us today and share your stories. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jason, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Your book, Baseball Epic, is about the life of people from the so-called dead ball era, which was in the early 1900s. What got you interested in this particular part of baseball history?
Well, probably the first spark, reading an anecdote about some of the players after there was a scandal in baseball in 1919. The World Series was rigged, and a number of players on the Chicago White Sox were implicated and ultimately ended up being banned from the game altogether. They never played again. And some of them wound up doing things like working in convenience stores. And I was kind of intrigued that someone who had that level of star status could fall to a place where they were sort of doing something that was fairly anonymous and were actually kind of trying to stay out of the limelight. From there, I just started reading more and more about that whole era, realizing that not just the disgraced players, but a lot of these players, after their careers were over, because it wasn't quite the high-earning sort of job that it is now, had to go back to whatever they were doing before, which in a lot of cases was blue-collar work.
Yeah, that's an important point. I think that baseball players weren't paid very much, and a lot of them had second jobs or came to the game already having money, didn't they?
That's right, yeah. So, I'd say, especially with the biographies that I have in the book, that seems to be the two main categories. It was either gentlemen players who came like from the Ivy Leagues, or players who came from what you might call industrial teams, like the local coal company would have a baseball team, or an auto manufacturer would have a baseball team. And at some point, they would be playing well enough that the major leagues would notice these guys, pull them in. But once their career was over, once they basically used up their bodies, it was back to the auto line.
Auto line, coal mine, whatever it was they were, doing. So with all of this as a context, then, what's so important about this era? Why should the average baseball fan pay attention to this? Why should they care about the dead ball era?
Maybe one of the things. Well, at least for me, I have a strange entry into baseball. I wasn't necessarily a big baseball fan before this book. My main interest has always been history, but to, like I said, with the anecdotes I started reading about just through happenstance, it generated an interest for me. This particular period in baseball history has a lot more variety and unpredictability than the game today. For example, because there wasn't the national broadcasting infrastructure set up, the kinds of things that could happen in any given stadium varied a lot. There were things that would happen that the rest of the country wouldn't be hearing about, and so these very unique cultures would start to grow up in individual cities. And, of course, at that time there were a lot more what you might call town ball clubs. where everyone would go see a game played by this. They weren't part of a league. They were just the local entertainment for the day. And all kinds of strange, quirky traditions would pop up. One thing that I think is fascinating is in early games, when a game was over, it was common for fans to just rush the field and completely surround the players. It's unfathomable to me now that ever happening, but back then that was sort of an expected moment at the end of games.
And these men were local celebrities. I mean, they were well known locally for their town team or whatever company they were playing for. But were there some players who had a national level of celebrity at all in those days?
Yeah, and I think probably it's the people that even if you don't know much about baseball, you've probably heard of, like, Ty Cobb, for example, or Babe Ruth, both of whom were playing during this period. And they were at the very top of the major leagues, so they had most of the attention. And at that point, yes, you could become a national star. But this book actually includes both of those players, but most of them were playing at a much lower level. They made it to the major leagues, most of them, but some of them had very short careers in the major leagues, but very long careers in baseball. So they might have been playing either in a minor league or in a company team, or they might have been doing what was called barnstorming, where they basically would just go from town to town playing ball games with whatever team would have them.
Jason Novak is an Oakland-based cartoonist. He is the author and illustrator of Baseball Epic, Famous and Forgotten Lives of the Dead Ball Era, a book of microbiographies of the men and women who shaped baseball. So are you a baseball history buff? What do you love about it? Who's your favorite player or maybe your favorite game from the past? Join us at 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. The pages of your book, Baseball Epic, include drawings and short descriptions about the life of people from the dead ball era. Why did you choose this particular format? You have a picture on the left and then a few sentences on the facing page.
I wanted to create sort of the experience of looking at baseball cards. So the typical format now for a baseball card, you've got the player on one side, and on the back it's usually a list of statistics. And very occasionally you'll get some biographical information, like the place they were born, or things like that. But I wanted to find a few biographical tidbits that might not ever make it on a baseball card. So it's a lot of the stuff focuses on their careers outside of actual playing.
Well, and the some of the information you include, it's not just their accomplishments or career highlights. You often include something about a fall from grace for a number of these players, or how they died. I noticed a number of them who died of accidental gunshots. What made you want to note some of the tribulations of these people?
Well, that era was a very rough one. There's a caveat with that. It seems like every age looks back on the past as being more primitive somehow. So I'm sure that players in the 1910s and 1920s probably thought that the generation before them was the really rowdy one. But it was definitely an age when people didn't have life expectancy was much shorter for a number of reasons.
And we'll pick that up in just a moment. We're talking baseball this morning with Jason Novak, author of Baseball Epic. Our conversation continues. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Well, the 2019 Major League Baseball season has officially kicked off. We're celebrating by looking back at the game as it was played in the first two decades of the 20th century, the so-called dead ball era. Jason Novak is an Oakland-based cartoonist whose latest book is titled Baseball Epic, Famous and Forgotten Lives of the Dead Ball Era. Have a question about the dead ball era of Major League Baseball? Interested in baseball history? What's the game meant to you? Share your story at 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jason, let's talk about some of the people you feature. One of them is Branch Rickey, who is best known for signing Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers. Talk to us about what you share about Rickey.
Well, so he actually had a very long career in baseball, going back to the turn of the century. And obviously, Jackie Robinson was signed in 1946, so it's pretty much half the century right there. And most of his roles in baseball had been sort of a management sort. But he, the thing I highlight in his bio is that when he was managing his college baseball team, there was actually a black player on the team, because this was before before segregation had become in the game itself had become quite so solidified. But whenever they would go around the country, that player was always singled out as having to use separate facilities. And it bothered Branch Rickey so much that he promised that player that he would do everything he could in baseball to try and change things. It took him 50 years, but eventually he was the first manager to sign a black player to the major leagues.
And you include a few interesting bits about Frank Corradin, who was he was a pitcher during the dead ball era. But more than that, tell us about Frank's many talents.
So, well, he also played violin, there's not a ton of information about him out there. But his nickname on the field was Fiddler. They called him Fiddler Corradin, and there's some sources say that he played in the symphony orchestra in his free time, but he also apparently between games in towns, he would go down to the local park and just busk. He would play for money just on the corner. So I wish there was more information, because that's such an intriguing tidbit, but I poured through a lot of newspaper records and I haven't been able to find a more detailed explanation of his violin talents.
Let's take a call. John is with us from Boaz. John, good morning.
Go Brewers.
Amen to that, brother.
What's your question for our guest? We got one game away from the World Series, and it put baseball back on the map. And I just want to thank you for your program. I have want to say about Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio and Henry Aaron. Babe Ruth was larger than life, and Joe DiMaggio went all the way to Hollywood. And Henry Aaron showed that African Americans can be just as good, if not better. A great inspiration for the kids and the youth.
John, thanks. Thanks for your call. You mentioned Babe Ruth earlier, Jason. What about Joe DiMaggio and Hammer and Hank?
Well, actually, I was born in the same town as Joe DiMaggio, Martinez, California. So, in the just downtown, you can see they still have the sign up DiMaggio's grocery store. So I feel sort of a personal connection to him, for sure.
You, one of the other players that you draw is Charles Albert Bender, more commonly called Chief Bender. He was a Native American pitcher for a Philadelphia team. Tell us his story.
Yeah, he actually had kind of a long career in baseball as a player. I think he played for over 20 years, mostly with the Philadelphia Athletics, which, of course, now by being in Oakland, we have the Athletics here. So there's that kind of feel. I have a soft spot for him in that respect. But he was one of the few high-profile Native American players in the major leagues at that time. But it wasn't easy. When he would play a game, he would get a lot of taunting from the people in the bleachers about his background. They would do war whoops and fling insults at him. But he was such a good player that if his team won at the end of the game, he would run around the perimeter of the field and just shout at the bleachers, "Foreigners, foreigners." He was definitely a very proud of his background.
The when you were researching Albert Bender, what were some of the other things you found out about him, and what was the connection to your own family's experience?
Yeah, so my great grandfather kind of had a lot of parallels with him. He had mixed European and Native American parents, and unfortunately, the environment he grew up in he was encouraged not to discuss his heritage. And it was something that the family, it was kind of, even when I was a kid and some of his siblings were still alive, it was kind of the elephant in the room. It wasn't something that we were really supposed to talk about. And I wish I could go back and inhabit that child I was then, because I feel like I would have had more license to ask the questions that the adults around me were afraid to ask, so that I could get a better read on what that experience was like for them. But what I take away from my family's experience is a kind of reticence that just wasn't there for Chief Bender, because he had to take ownership because he was in the spotlight, and there was no denying that he had a certain kind of background. So he was very proud of it, and I think that that's pretty inspiring, considering especially the time when a lot of Native Americans didn't have even basic things like citizenship. So.
Jason Novak is an Oakland-based cartoonist, and he's the author and illustrator of Baseball Epic, Famous and Forgotten Lives of the Dead Ball Era, a book of microbiographies of the men and women who shaped the game. Jackie Robinson, of course, we talked about earlier in connection with Branch Rickey, broke the Major League Baseball color barrier. But years before he came into the league, a few players at least tried to take the first steps toward that goal. Tell us about John Donaldson and how he trailblazed for players of color.
Yeah, so he was a star in his own right as a player. And in the book, I call them the Negro Leagues because that's how what they were called beginning around 1920, when the black players started to form official leagues. But before that, you would almost call them pre-league teams, but they were all black teams. So as a shorthand, I say Negro Leagues, even though technically a historian might say, well, you know, we wouldn't have called them that until a little bit later. But anyway, he was a star in at that time to the magnitude that even when he was barnstorming throughout the country, white fans would come out and watch him in droves because his celebrity was of that magnitude. So he had a lot of clout as a player. Beyond that, he was so good that this actually requires some background. After the Spanish-American War, when the U.S. briefly acquired Cuba, the major leagues started sending teams down to Havana to play the local talent there, because baseball was also starting to get big in Cuba. And it turns out that the players there were phenomenal, and the major leagues from the U.S. were losing games, and it made the managers thirsty for the talent down there. But the major difference between Cuba and the United States was that there wasn't nearly the color line. So the teams there were what you might have called at the time mixed teams. And the managers were always trying to scheme, how can we basically whitewash this Cuban player and get him onto a major league team? And they tried in several instances. They were successful in doing that. But in the case of John Donaldson, there was a manager for the New York Giants, I believe it was. John McGraw, who tried to encourage him to play for the major leagues, disguised as a Cuban, basically. And John Donaldson wouldn't have any of it. He said, I'm proud of my background. I don't want to pretend to be something that I'm not. He did ultimately end up working as a scout for the major leagues. But his efforts to try and sign black players always came to nothing. And as a result, he resigned to that position in frustration. So he was definitely a champion of his background.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to get to a player in your book with a Wisconsin connection. One of the players you feature is Cy Williams, who retired to Wisconsin after his baseball career quickly. What was it that he was known for after baseball?
Well, he was an architect, and he was kind of a peculiar architect at that. He, I guess, he specialized in doing buildings that had a kind of a theme. So he would do clubhouses and resorts and things like that. So I know in one case he did a boating club building that looked like a ship. And in another case, he did a sort of a resort building that looked like a medieval German castle. So that was kind of interesting. And I was trying to think, maybe it was the skill that you use in baseball and architecture is that sense of space.
Yeah.
So I like to think that he learned that playing baseball.
Well, this is a fascinating book. Jason Novak, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Jason Novak, Oakland-based cartoonist. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, and more. He's the author and illustrator of Baseball Epic. Coming up next, one Wisconsin school district is tracking students and buses through a GPS system. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The Hortonville School District is tracking students and buses through a GPS monitoring system as part of an effort to keep kids safe. But some are worried it's sharing too much information about the whereabouts of students. Two employees of the school district will join us in a moment to explain how this program works and why the district chose this particular technology. Parents, do you wish this software was available at your child's school? And how would this tool help you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Scott Colantonio is the technology director at the Hortonville Area School District, and he joins us this morning. Scott, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Tell us about this system and what it is and how the Hortonville School District got involved with it in the first place.
Sure. So the Hortonville Area School District is a school district that is constantly looking for opportunities to improve operations. And our transportation department and our school offices are regularly trying to address needs that deal with trying to find students that parents are looking for. And as a result, Harry Steenbach from our transportation department had researched quite a few different solutions to try to find out a way in which we can improve the access to that information. So that when parents are looking for students, that the school district officials are able to, in a very timely manner, provide that information. What we did is we went out and tried to find different options that allowed us to be able to be more effective in terms of finding the students or tracking them to be which bus that they might be on. And as a result, we came up and looked at different solutions that involved using technology. We have students in a pilot scenario right now using ID cards or key cards to be able to fob their way onto a bus. And that system using a tablet that transfers that information to a secure website allows the site officials to know more effectively where students are when they're not in our schools and they're on our bus. Now, once they get off the bus, they'll fob their way off, and that students will then be in the care of the people that they're supposed to be with. But in the interim time, there's that kind of situation where parents may want to know, hey, there's been a change. I want to know where my child is. And when you call the office, in the current situation, students are expected, or the office people are expected to get in touch with transportation, and transportation is trying to get in touch with bus drivers. This allows our offices to be more effective in terms of being able to get that information in a more timely manner.
Harry Steenbach is the Hortonville Area School District Transportation Director. Harry, thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you for inviting us.
Harry, the district's been using this tracking software as part of a trial for 18 months now, and we just heard Scott tell us kind of how it works. I guess when I was reading a little background on this, I hadn't really thought about the fact that that kids get on the wrong bus or they have to go to a different place on different days or different weeks. How often is it that students kind of get a little bit lost in the system?
Typically, the That happens almost daily, where a student will, if they're supposed to go on two different buses, they get confused, especially when you start talking to little students, you know, first graders and that, they'll forget where they're supposed to go. And so they'll hop on their normal bus, and they're not supposed to be on typically at-home bus because the parents are both working or whatever the case may be. So basically it happens daily.
And Scott, were there, you mentioned the tablet that's going to be in the driver's view. There were concerns that this system could violate distracted driving laws for bus drivers since they have to access this tablet while driving. How was this addressed?
Well, the Trans 300 allows to use a GPS-type device, electronic device, as long as it's out of the vision of the driver when they're driving, and that the driver cannot touch it or can't be manipulating that device at all. And so what we did was we worked with the routing company, which Lynx Routing System is out of Baraboo, and in United GPS to make it so that it does it automatically. It'll show the picture of the student, and it'll follow the direction of the bus, and it does it automatically. The driver doesn't touch anything.
We're talking with Harry Steenbach, Hortonville Area School District Transportation Director, and Scott Colantonio, who is the Technology Director at the Hortonville Area School District, about a new program they're putting in to keep track of where students are in their system. Parents, what do you think of this? Would it be helpful to know your child's whereabouts, or do you prefer not to know where your child is at all times? Students, do you feel comfortable being tracked this way? Why or why not? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Scott, another thing that you discovered early on is that there were some privacy concerns with using this system. What were they?
Well, actually, when we looked at the privacy terms from Unite GPS, where all the data is being held, they included options to be able to allow for ad management, to allow for parents to determine which ads they were going to see as they were getting information about their child, that they preserve the right to basically share information with publishers and advertisers or connected sites. And for us in the school district, that's a no-no. We basically went out and looked at the Department of Education's recommendations for privacy, and we introduced terms to the company that said along the lines that the vendor is prohibited from mining data and for any purposes other than those agreed upon by us. And that data mining or scanning of this data for purposes of advertising or marketing is strictly prohibited. We're in a day and age where we want to make sure that we comply with federal laws that deal with family privacy, and we want to make sure we provide a safe environment. We're here to solve problems, and we're trying to make sure that we don't introduce new ones along the way.
And Scott, how is this helpful then for other districts in the state that may add this technology in the future?
Well, from a legal perspective, what we did is we took a look at this vendor's terms, and we were able to work very effectively with them. The Department of Education's guidelines for student privacy in terms of the data and the family privacy rights is something that not only serves the needs of the Hortonville Area School District, but wow, we just were able to make sure that this service was available for every customer that is going to be using Unite GPS. The provider was very agreeable, understood the situation that was at hand, and ultimately is now providing that for all school districts that they're going to be using that service, and we feel that's a very big benefit for everybody involved.
Harry, the district has been testing in different tracking systems since 2014. What have you found that's worked and not worked?
Well, we have we found a couple systems that were fairly accurate. This has obviously been the most accurate and precise as locating and keeping track and relaying the information to us. Some of the other systems, they worked to a certain extent. The biggest issue was their cell phone connection. If they would lose connection, they wouldn't automatically connect back up. And it would end up to be a 10, 15, 20-minute lapse in information. They had the information, but it wasn't transferred over to us. And if you're a parent that has been looking for your child ever,
20 minutes is forever. Yeah, no,
it's a lifetime. So we had to make sure that we were going to offer the best possible solution. If we're going to do this for the parents, we need to have the best thing we could find.
Scott, right now only administrators can view the location of students and buses in real time. Parents can't do that. Why is that?
Well, right now we're looking at the fact that we're solving one problem and not trying to create a bunch of others in the process. The idea of having the office staff, the secretaries, and the administrators having access to this information is critical for us. They're part of the safety team. What we're doing, though, at the Hortonville Area School District is we have a great history of working with our local first responders on our safety team. We work with experts from RITA Security. I'm actually involved with the Department of Justice Office School Safety Technology Advisory Teams. We want to make sure that we're taking a look at all the different types of opportunities to improve our services, but not introduce new threats that might cause us problems that we don't really want. And I think it's going to be a great process for us. Harry's a member of our safety team. We'll be meeting next week. He has done an exemplary job of helping with bus safety. And I look forward to making sure that we provide input from a lot of different people so that we ultimately make great decisions in terms of who should have access to this information and how.
And Scott, how have parents felt about the overall trial?
I'm going to allow Harry to answer that question.
Okay, Harry, how parents responded to the trial?
The parents have responded overwhelmingly, accept it, and are looking for it. They've appreciated that understanding that it's the best interest of the child that we're looking for. And a lot of them that the buses are not being presently on that trial have called and asked, when is my child going to get it, because I'd really like it. And so they've been overwhelmingly, there has been some concerns with some, but after explaining what it's for and how the system's working, anybody that had any concerns has been acceptable with it.
Okay. Okay, we're going to keep this conversation going. We'll continue to look at technology on Wisconsin school buses with Harry Steenbuck and Scott Colantonio of the Horton School Area School District. Parents, has your child ever gotten on the wrong bus or gotten off at the wrong stop? And could this type of tracking have changed that outcome? Give us a call with your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The Hortonville School District is tracking students and buses through a GPS monitoring system as part of an effort to keep kids safe. But some are worried that it's maybe sharing too much information about the whereabouts of students. Are you a bus driver or substitute bus driver that would find this helpful during your shift? Or is this one more thing to manage when you're already busy getting kids to school and focused on the road? There's a line for you to make a comment or tell us your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Harry Steenbach is the Hortonville Area School District Transportation Director. Scott Colantonio is the Technology Director of the Hortonville Area School District. Harry, tell us about instances where this trial has helped to locate a student.
Well, we've had that where already students have not really, they've gotten on the wrong bus, and we were able to look and say, okay, we actually got a hold of the driver and says you need to get this person off the bus. It was a sub driver on there. They didn't know the students, and so we looked at it and said, you know, yes, that student is on the bus. You need to get them off, because nine out of ten times when they're driving down the road is when we go on the radio and ask for if that student's on the bus and they're busy driving already. So they don't have time to actually ask each student individually, and sometimes everybody, you know, that student is a little hesitant to say that they're on the wrong bus sometimes, and so everybody says, no, they're not on there, and then we continue to go on with the route. So now we're able to do that right away. We can look at it and say, that student's on your bus. We need to adjust whatever we got to do to make sure that they get either to the right spot or on the right bus.
And what if a parent decides to drive their kid to school one day, or their child goes home with a friend on their bus? How many calls are these parents going to have to make to account for these things that, well, they happen? How much of a hassle is this?
It's not going to be a hassle, because the school has always had the policy that a student can ride home with somebody else. It's just that they need a note or something like that. We've had quite a few times, lots of times the parents will call us and let us know that their child's going to have some friends riding, or that they're going to go with somebody else on a different bus, and we'll let the driver know. But this way, when they get on, we know they got on at the right spot, and we know they got off at the right spot. So they can still do that. It just brings it to the attention to the driver that when they scan their card, this student's not really assigned to it, so they make sure that they adjust whatever they got to adjust to make sure the students are sitting together and they get off at the right spot.
Right. Scott, this software is being tested on two buses, about 130 students using swipe cards. What is the next phase going to look like?
I can answer that for Scott, nothing else. We are installing 10 more tablets. We've been working on that this week and getting more cards assigned. So we're going to have one school completely covered with the program, and then about 5 buses at another location that is going to start. And then because the way we load buses and unload buses, there's everybody gets on and off pretty much at the same time. At 7:45, we release the students from the buses, and they all start swiping the cards. And that was one of my concerns yet, is handling that amount of data in a short period of time. Within a couple minutes, they're all off the bus. So that's why we decided the school board, they allowed us to purchase 10 more, and we're going to have that data feed, you know, make sure they can handle that mass amount of data and still have accurate account.
Let's take a call. Katie is with us from Janesville. Katie, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I am a driver for one of our local districts. However, we own our own buses. So what you're saying, I guess my question is, do you contract out your bus service? If that's
no.
the case, okay, so you have your own buses. Okay. We have our dedicated runs. Our drivers know the grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins of our kids. We know our kids, you know, if we see something different at their houses, we're calling in well checks. If we get a kid on the bus that, oh, I want to go home with Johnny, we have radios and we can call in to the school and say, hey, we've got a different kid. I guess I understand what you're saying, and I know we've talked about that. But if you've got your drivers and they have dedicated runs, you're kind of, it's a redundant system already. I know it's a different okay. thing with sub drivers.
Okay, Katie, we get it. Let's give Harry a chance to respond here.
You know, and the sub drivers is that's a huge issue, because that's when it usually happens, because the sub driver doesn't. And the one thing that I'm looking at with the tablet, I mean, the student tracking was initially what I was really looking with, but the tablet now allows that sub driver, because we are short drivers, and no matter what, I've driven a lot of routes, and when you have to take a piece of paper and try to follow a map as to where you have to go, to find those kids, that's a danger right there by itself. And if we can do this electronically so that you don't have to have that map or that roster, you can see where you're going to go without taking your hands off the wheel, and you can concentrate on everything that's going on around you, to me that's just almost worth it by itself.
But,
a sub driver is the one, you know, that needs the most help. If nobody was ever sick or needs to take off for any reason, you maybe wouldn't need it.
Well, Harry, do you think that it's also a big advantage in the fact that we're reducing those distractions when there are those special situations where we're trying to track down a student for a parent, that the office staff can actually handle those situations without having to distract the driver as often?
Correct. Yeah, we can, anybody can look on it and see where that is, because our present process is once there's a student that's missing, okay, on the buses, we pull them all over, and the drivers have to go through the bus to try to locate that child. And 9 times out of 10, they're on the wrong bus, and there was a sub driver on that route, and he didn't know who the children were.
Harry Steenbach is the Hortonville Area School District Transportation Director. Scott Colantonio is the Technology Director at Hortonville Area School District. Harry, at what point do you see this being available for your entire bus fleet, the whole school district?
I would, as long as this phase of the testing, I would love to see that we get it into the budget and start it at the start of the next school year.
And what are the? How much does this system cost? What's the cost to buy it? And then I'm assuming that you have to continue to pay for the service.
We have to continue to pay. There's a yearly fee with the buses that we're going to have. It's going to be approximately $40,000 a year to continue it. And initially, you know, we're over $100,000, but. You have to understand that'll be with everything involved, and that is all considering all the time and labor, and as you do any new project, there's a lot of labor involved with correcting little issues that come up.
Harry, or Scott, well, you've explained this a matter of safety. What do you say to those who may feel this is revealing too much information about the whereabouts of students?
Well, if I can give just the first crack at that. Hey, John, do you remember the day when you could just go walking into any school that the doors were wide open? Because that wasn't that long ago. And we came to recognize that we have a responsibility of providing safe opportunities for kids. Our parents actually appreciate the reasonable precautions that we take to make sure that we not only provide a secure environment, but that we know exactly what's going on in terms of the child's safety.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Harry Steenbach, Hortonville Area School District Transportation Director. Scott Colantonio, Technology Director. I'm John Munson on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.